Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com.
The busiest week of earnings for the second quarter reporting season. Meanwhile, we are getting the trickle out of the big tech names. Amazon reporting after the bell today. Shares lower by 0.75% today, although a lot of people are expecting them to deliver strong results on the heels of their one-day shipping initiative. Joining us now to discuss, Dave Garrity, Chief Market Strategist for Laidlaw & Company and also a partner at BT Block. He is joining us here in our 11:30 studios. Dave, I want to start with Amazon. What are you expecting in terms of their earnings and sort of the boost that they're expected to get from the one-day shipping initiative?
I think Amazon is going to be coming in with fairly strong results, probably looking at revenues, possible growth, somewhere north of 15% year over year. Clearly the question here for Amazon isn't so much just the strength of the volumes through their e-commerce platform, but really more what's going on with Amazon Web Services and the fact that they've continued to reap returns from their leading return as being a cloud computing platform. Prime is a wonderful thing. However, at the end of the day, the engine for profit growth of the company is what they're doing in terms of the ability to control data.
So, David, on the data front, you were talking before we went on the air about Facebook. They had numbers last night, really strong top line growth, 28%. The stock's down 1.5%. You were calling out some issues about their cost of goods sold. Give us a sense of what you're thinking.
Certainly as a monopoly, if you will, in terms of social media, Facebook is realizing these monopoly rents. The thing that's been interesting here, looking more on the regulatory front towards not just the U.S. government and what the Hill is saying, but also overseas, clearly the fact of the matter is looking at the business model for these companies, Facebook, they pay no cost for the data that we provide. And there have been estimates out there that this could be giving a benefit to the company, Facebook, and other monopolies within social media or within tech, something in the order of about $75 to $100 billion a year. There are discussions taking place in the U.S. and elsewhere of taxing this. I mean, effectively, what would happen if, say, General Motors, paid nothing for the steel that they use to build their cars? The model and the argument here is effectively the same in terms of looking at Facebook. So the issue is costs potentially are going to be rising as a result of this regulatory inquiry and oversight with respect to the industry. So margins will come under pressure. Clearly, the revenue momentum continues to grow, and that can support many things. But the fact of the matter is that life is going to become far more complicated, not just for Facebook, but also potentially for Amazon and Google as a result of the antitrust inquiry which the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, have launched.
Which companies of the big tech names do you think will get most affected by this, the DOJ's efforts?
My selection here would be Facebook. To the extent that Facebook does depend upon other companies for data. So other companies, I think, will pass costs onto Facebook. And I would simply say that even though Facebook, on a tactical basis, has had a win with respect to this $5 billion settlement with the FTC because it removes liability for the officers, the fact of the matter is that Mark Zuckerberg has shown himself to be brazen in his dealings with regulatory authorities, both here in the U.S. and elsewhere. And I think this puts him squarely in the crosshairs for the foreseeable future.
There's also a question of diversification. We were talking about Amazon, and I thought it was striking that you said that the AWS, the sort of cloud computing services, was really where the focus needs to be, because on the actual bread and butter of their business, the sort of market platform, it's sort of increasingly a utility. They just try to crimp margins as much as possible, or that's how they'd like to put it out there as. How crucial is it for big tech to basically create their mainstay businesses as utilities, but then have these peripheral businesses that actually give them their money?
That's a very good point. And it's and in terms of looking at the monopoly that these companies have within their various sectors, the argument has been put forward that these are really more utilities. And as utilities, they should be regulated and allowed to have the returns that utilities historically have enjoyed, which means that these companies, much as AT&T did some time ago, have to think about setting up unregulated businesses to potentially drive their returns and continue to attract investor attention.
Well, that brings up the ultimate question of risk, regulatory risk for these companies. Is there a scenario where they could be broken up? That's certainly something that Senator Elizabeth Warren and presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren has suggested.
Well, I mean, going towards a breakup, you know, is a possible solution or a possible scenario, but one which arguably comes after you've gone through this process of inquiry and very likely you go past the 2020 general election, you know, with the solution, you know, does it get imposed with the 117th Congress when it adjourns in 2021? I think it may take a little longer than that, but the fact is it's on the horizon and investors in looking at the sector have to have this on their radar.
What's the next step for regulatory action from your point of view that you're expecting?
I think it's really more a matter of various entities, whether it's the Department of Justice, whether it's the Federal Trade Commission, whether it's the Antitrust Subcommittee of the House Judicial Committee conducting their hearings. And as these hearings and inquiries are conducted, clearly there's going to be a news flow coming out of these. Clearly, the people who are going to do well out of all this are the lobby armies of K Street down in Washington, D.C. It's going to be a bang-up year for attorneys going into 2020.
And, Paul, it already has been.
It already has been. It's that something's never changed. David Garrity, thank you so much for joining us. David's a chief market strategist at Laidlaw & Company, also a partner at BT Block. Talking technology, we got tech earnings this week, and clearly investors will be focusing on the operations of these companies as they should, but they'll also be focusing, I think, increasingly, as David suggested, on the regulatory oversight that these companies are now finding themselves under, which is a little bit of a new issue for them. Most of these tech companies historically have, dealt with European oversight, but not necessarily oversight coming from U.S. regulators, U.S. politicians. That appears to be changing. The question is, how will they deal with it, and will there be some winners and losers?
The scores of ultra net worth families have risen dramatically over the past few decades. And a big question now for those investors is, where do they put their money at a time of high valuations, easing central banks, and some concerns growing about the momentum in the global economy? Here to answer all of those questions is Michael Sonnenfeld. He's chairman and founder of Tiger 21, which is a consortium of ultra net worth investors who get together and talk honestly about what they're doing, if I get that correctly, Michael. So thank you for being here. So what's the latest in terms of the optimism or lack thereof among the members of Tiger 21?
Thanks for having me. Over the last 6 months, sentiment is shifting slowly. Today, people are less optimistic. Those who were very positive are less so. But it's still smooth sailing for the moment. People have pulled out of a little bit of real estate, brought it down from the low 30% allocation to the high 20s, taking profits where they could. Our members, because they're all former entrepreneurs, are much more comfortable in the private markets, private equity, private real estate. So they only have about 23% allocation to the public markets. Hedge funds have been very low, but the hedge funds that are getting interest now are the defensive hedge funds, what would be called credit funds, where you have distressed debt. So there are a lot of distressed debt funds gearing up, ready for the next downturn, and our members are looking at that as well.
So, Michael, one of the things that we've noticed is with some of these tech companies coming public, like Uber and Lyft, for example, is that maybe the valuations in the private market have gotten maybe stretched. So when they come to the equity public markets, they maybe even have a down valuation. What are your members saying about, given that they are entrepreneurs, about kind of the valuations in venture world and the private equity world?
So the valuations are clearly high in the public markets. But long term, people still believe that, for instance, technology stocks have greater scalability. So after the index funds, which our members are increasingly interested in because they know they can't outperform the market, tech stocks would be the one subset. But even within tech stocks now, you have a divergence, whereas a year ago, our members thought Amazon and Facebook were two tech stocks. With all the challenges facing Facebook today, regulatory and so forth, those are diverging. I would say our members are a little less interested in Facebook, although it had good earnings. It now has a $5 billion fine. Amazon doesn't have those problems today.
So I'm curious, you said that your members were reducing their allocation to real estate slightly. I'm wondering if you can give me a sense or give us a sense of where they're reducing those allocations. In other words, sure. Is it in the big cities? Is it in warehouses? Is it commercial real estate?
So first of all, in real estate, you really have a tale of two cities. You have the gateway cities where prices are still very high. And outside of the gateway cities, you have things like the retail apocalypse, where you have streets that are just empty of retailers because of what's going on. So retail is still real estate is still our members' largest allocation. That's an important thing. So the fact that it came down from the high 30s to 27, 28%, it's still their largest allocation. What they've done is where they had an opportunity to take low-hanging fruit that was easily sold at a very high value. They took those off to build cash and get ready for the next downturn.
So that was going to be my next question. What did they buy? And it sounds like they bought nothing. They're just building their cash cushion.
If they're buying, it in the real estate is more on the income-producing side rather than the speculative side. Unless, because our members, so many made their money in real estate, sometimes they can see a value that nobody else can see. An empty building to you might be frightening. It might be an extraordinary opportunity to one of our members. But generally, there's a lot of interest in income substitutes. So workforce housing, as an example, is very stable, good cash flows, although even that's gotten a little pricey over the last year or two.
So, Michael, where are you seeing with your company, Tiger 21, where are you seeing the growth in wealth? I mean, I'm assuming that, you know, there are lots of billionaires in the U.S. Where are you seeing the growth? Where are you opening groups and offices and so on?
So we've identified the 60 markets around the globe that members like Tiger members would like to either work in, live in, invest in, or connect to. We're already in over 30 of those markets. So over the next 5 years, we'll probably roll out the next 30. Our market, by the way, is not the billionaires. Our market is from 10 million to a billion. People have created all the great meat and potato businesses. And one way to think about it, if you're a major league football, baseball, or basketball player, you're about one in 17,000 by accomplishment. Our members are of a similar a scale of success within their field of entrepreneur, minus the all-stars. We don't go for the billionaires.
I'm wondering, when you talk about building cash or getting defensive or distressed debt investors trying raising capital to deploy to take advantage of a downturn, why are they feeling like that's going to happen somewhat soon, given the fact that you've got central banks that are easing and doing what they can to prevent it?
Yeah. So I think our members are looking for the all-elusive, all-weather portfolio, something that will be durable. We're not traders by nature. Our members are entrepreneurs who built businesses over 10, 20, 30 years. So they're looking to have a portfolio that will last through good times and bad. So they see what happened in 2008. What were the strategies that did well? And the one thing they know is you don't want to ever have to sell at the bottom. You have to have enough cash to weather through the bottom so you're not forced to liquidate great assets at discount prices. So that would be the main thing, is have enough cash not to be forced to liquidate your great investments at the wrong time.
Paul, this is so fascinating to me because it's not just ultra net worth individuals. It's all the big firms, private equity firms, private debt firms, et cetera. And I have to wonder if this will sort of cushion any blow and kind of create a buffer on price declines in a downturn, because you've got just so much cash there waiting to pick up any bargains.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you'd like to think so. Maybe we saw that in December last year. You know, we saw that in December. We had that sell-off in December, and then it came roaring back this year. Michael Sonnenfeld, thanks so much for joining us. Michael's a chairman and founder of Tiger 21, about $71 billion under management across all of their members. Just a unique way to aggregate wealthy individuals who have created companies and value and entrepreneurs. And the question is, when those people liquidate their investments, what do they do with the cash? Well, yesterday was certainly an important day for President Trump as former special counsel Robert Mueller testified in front of two congressional committees. To get a postmortem on that performance, we welcome Ken Nowaday. He is a partner at Venable LLP. He was also a former corruption and fraud prosecutor for the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. Ken, thanks so much for joining us. President Trump yesterday claimed that it was a great day for him. Do you agree?
I disagree with that. And the reason is the report is still the report. All the facts in the report are still the facts. And one thing that Bob Mueller did clarify and say pretty strongly was that the report did not exonerate the president. So I can't say you can say it was a good day.
So I guess that my question is, going forward, what precedent does this set? Because the special prosecutor came out with a report. He said he could not exonerate President Trump. He also said that there were some very concerning things, particularly pertaining to the WikiLeaks section. These are the things that the Democrats are sort of clinging to as justification for why they did this in the first place, because they're getting a bunch of criticism today. My question is, moving forward, where do we go from here with this report?
I think we're in the same place we were before, which is Bob Mueller has always made it clear that he's the third-party narrator of a great book, but he's not going to give you the last chapter. The last chapter has to come from somewhere else. He's going to bear witness. He's going to tell you what the facts are, but he's not going to be passing judgment. So I think we're in the same place where we always have been up until this point after the report, which is, will there be impeachment proceedings?
So let's just... You know, looking at yesterday, and so the bare bones testimony we got yesterday from Mr. Mueller plus the report, do you think that moves the needle at all as it relates to the legal jeopardy that President Trump will face either while he's in office or after office?
Maybe it moves it where he's in more jeopardy. And the reason for that is not because Bob Mueller brought anything new to the table that wasn't in the report. It's because the public discourse, the public vetting, the public attention on the facts in that report are still being discussed and focused on. And frankly, the more you look at those facts in that report, the more you talk about them, it's kind of hard not to look away.
The more that I listened to Robert Mueller yesterday and his comments since the publication of the report, the brief ones that he has made, the more the contrast between him and some of the politicians sort of remains stark in my mind. This idea that he is committed to process. He wants to basically say the institution will provide justice. I am committed to it. He is a commensurate Marine, as a recent guest said. I'm just wondering whether career prosecutors and career workers in the U.S. government are starting to change their mentality about faith in the institution if they feel like it isn't rewarded in the sense of, you know, actually being as meaningful as they hoped.
I think without question, the DOJ's credibility as an institution is taking a hit with these proceedings, with what's going on, with how everything was handled. And, it, you know, I don't know what line DOJ, AUSAs, and prosecutors are thinking, but it's got to hurt. And it's my question is whether this is a permanent shift of the viewpoint of DOJ and federal their place in federal prosecutions and seeking justice, or whether this will revert back to the norm.
So, Con, it's not just the Mueller investigation. President Trump also is facing some potential liability with investigations here in New York. I think there's some federal prosecutors as well as the Southern District of New York looking at some of the Trump organizations, for example. Can you give us an update on where you think the status is of some of those investigations are?
Well, first off, I think it seems pretty clear that the campaign finance fraud investigation that the Southern District of New York was looking into up here has been closed, and I'm basing that on the unsealing letter that was submitted to Michael Cohen's sentencing court that said that part of the investigation is done. I don't know where the investigations stand with respect to the Trump Organization. I know it's been publicly reported that there are those investigations going on, as well as investigations by the New York Attorney General, who I suspect is going to be more aggressive because they're not part of the federal system.
I'm wondering, what do you think is most discouraging for federal prosecutors and career people in the government with respect to the way that the Mueller investigation was handled?
I think the unfairness of both sides in asking Mueller and his team to do something that they were somewhat constrained from doing. They were doing their job. And having your work turned into a partisan fight, I think, is what is discouraging for people. I think also seeing it play out in public, the tension, the obvious tension between the Attorney General Barr and Mueller and his team, where it's publicly displayed that they had differing views about what conclusions Mueller could reach or not. And Barr took it upon himself to reach a conclusion that Mueller didn't. And seeing that play out in public, it really hurts.
So, Khan, you know, if in the legal community today, do you think the Mueller report serves as a basis for impeachment? Is that the belief, or is it belief that there's just not enough there?
I think the Mueller report is there is a lot of there. And it is incumbent on the fact finders, and here the fact finders are ultimately going to be Congress, to decide and pass judgment. But it's a very in-depth report with a lot of juicy facts, inculpatory facts in there.
Khan Nowaday, thank you so much for being with us. Your thoughts are always insightful. Khan Nowaday is a partner at Venable LLP. He is a former prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. He spent 9 years there focusing on corruption and fraud.
Time to check in with Bloomberg Opinion. We're joined by opinion columnist Elise Martinuzzi. Elise, thanks so much for joining us. We had a big day for Mario Draghi today and the ECB. Let's hear what he had to say.
The risks surrounding the euro area growth outlook remain tilted to the downside, reflecting the prolonged presence of uncertainties related to geopolitical factors, the rising threat of protectionism, and vulnerabilities in emerging markets.
That was ECB President Mario Draghi speaking this morning, talking about the slowdown in growth and some of the concern there. Elise Martinuzzi, Bloomberg Opinion columnist, thanks so much for joining us. Elise, just real quickly, what was your main takeaway from what we heard this morning from Mr. Draghi?
Well, I think, you know, there's going to be, you know, some stimulus on the way. He's signaling this might, you know, come as soon as September. You saw banks initially rally on the back of expectations that there might well be some mitigating actions for them in the way of potentially deposit tiering. Of course, the banks have to pay the ECB money, have to pay the ECB to part their funds, and that's been hurting them. And that's where we are.
And yet we saw a reversal in markets. This I find really interesting because initially bond yields dropped to record lows, certainly in Germany, and there was a rally all across the fixed income world in Europe. That has since shifted, especially after Mario Draghi suggested that perhaps the decisions were not unanimous at this point.
Yes, no, that's right. It seems that some also work remains to be done, for example, on how they might relieve banks in the way of deposit tiering. It seems like their analysis is still underway. So, yes, I think that the takeaway changed as the press conference evolved.
So, Elisa, so Mario Draghi, he is stepping down as president of the European Central Bank in October, but there's still some questions about some of his dealings in the past and some of his actions in the past as it relates to the Banca Montepaschi in Italy. I know you wrote a column about that. What are some of the key issues from that you are looking at?
Well, basically, you know, the ECB is a very young banking supervisor. They only officially became the region's chief regulator in 2014. And the idea was that, you know, you'd have a European-wide regulator that wouldn't be influenced by national politics, national inclinations, which have, you know, sometimes led to regulators locally being too permissive, for example. But what we've seen in the case of Montepaschi, which is potentially quite an extreme case, is that, you know, based on the information that we have had, you know, that the ECB potentially, you know, bent the rules a little bit in its latest rescue of Monte Paschi 2 years ago. And that is raising questions as to the workings of the ECB as a banking regulator. You know, particularly now, it's the early days of this role. And it's important to understand, how does the ECB work? How does it come to its conclusions? And how was it, what led to them not taking into consideration or not giving considerable consideration to the fact that Monte Paschi was probably insolvent when it was bailed out. So understanding how the mechanics of that decision unfolded would be helpful.
So given the fact that Christine Lagarde is going to step in as the next ECB president, what do you think she needs to do to shore up confidence in the mechanics of the ECB?
I think more transparency to begin with. This is a very young institution, as I said. It has many overlapping arms within it. It's not entirely clear sometimes how decisions are taken. And I think more transparency would be helpful in that regard. And, the European Commission has also singled out the fact that there needs to be more transparency. So I think it's very important because these initial instances are going to set important precedents for the future.
Well, Lisa, what's the sense in the European banking community as it relates to the ECB as a regulator? Has it been effective? I mean, is there uncertainty between local regulations and ECB-wide regulations? Is that causing some of the issues?
I think, Bloomberg News ran sort of a report card about a year ago on how it's done as a supervisor. And I think, it's scraped by with a little bit more than a pass. I think the sense is that in some areas they've been a little bit too slow to move. For example, with regards to the buildup of bad loans, particularly in Southern Europe. And more decisive and swifter action would be welcome, by the market. I don't get the sense that there is necessarily concern as to how the institution works, but it's more how effective it is.
Elisa Martinuzzi, thank you so much for being with us. It's always illuminating. Elisa Martinuzzi is a columnist covering finance for Bloomberg Opinion, joining us from London. You can read more on all of her work and other stories from Bloomberg Opinion at Bloomberg.com/opinion on the terminal at OPIN Go.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.